myself. Whereas last night I longed for home, I couldn't picture turning tail and running on the basis of Rafe's veiled suggestion about my personal safety. So what was I doing? Trying to satisfy myself that I'd done what I could? The deal I made with myself was to keep following leads until the trail ran out. If I came up against a blank wall, then I could return home with a clear conscience. In the meantime, I had a job, and I was intent on doing it. Yeah, right, you chicken shit, I thought. I went through a pack and a half of index cards without any startling revelations. I shuffled them twice and laid them out like a hand of solitaire, scanning row after row for telling details. For instance, I'd made a note that Cecilia'd told me she got home around 10 o'clock the night Tom died. She said she'd seen the ambulance, but had no idea it had been summoned for her brother. Could she have seen the woman walking down the road? It occurred to me the woman might have been staying at the Nodal Lake Cabins, in which case her stroll might not have had anything to do with Tom. Worth asking, at any rate, just to eliminate the issue.
End of Disc 7. Disc 8.
Chapter 21. Cecilia was late getting back. Instead of returning at 11:30, it was closer to 12:15 when she finally walked in the door. She was dressed for church in a baggy blue tweed suit with bumblebee scatterpins on the lapel. The white blouse underneath featured a frothy burst of lace at the neck. She expressed no surprise when she saw me, and in my paranoid state, I imagined my presence had been reported in advance. She opened the half-door to the office, closed it behind her, put her handbag on the desk, and turned to look at me. "Now, what can I do for you? I hear you're staying at Selma's, so it can't be a room you've come to ask about." "I'm still working on this business of Tom's death." 7 weeks ago tomorrow." "Hard to take it in," she said. "Do you happen to remember who was staying here that weekend?" "At the motel? That's easy." She reached for the registration ledger, licked her index finger, and began to page back through the weeks. March became February as she reversed the days. The week of February 1st appeared. She ran a finger down the list of names. "A party of skiers, maybe 6 of them in 2 cabins. I gave 'em hemlock and spruce, as far away from the office as I could make it, because I knew they'd get to partying. That type always do. I remember them toting in more cases of beer than they had luggage. Complained a lot, too. Water pressure, heat, nothing suited them," she said, shooting me a look. "Anyone else? Any single women?"
"Meaning what?"
"Not meaning anything, Cecilia," I said patiently. "I'm following up on the CHP report. Tennyson says he saw a woman walking down the road. She may have been a figment of his imagination. It's possible she had nothing to do with Tom. It would be helpful to find her, so I'm hoping against hope she was staying here that night. That way you could tell me how to get in touch with her." She checked the register again.
"Nope. Married couple from Los Angeles, or so they claimed. Only saw that pair when they crawled out of bed to take meals. And one other family with a couple of kids. Wife was in a wheelchair, so I doubt he saw her."
"What about you? When you came back from the movies, was there anyone on the road? This would have been between 10 or 10:30. Cecilia seemed to give it some thought, and then shook her head.
"The only thing I remember is someone using the phone out there. I try to discourage strangers stopping off to make calls, tromping up and down the porch stairs, ripping pages from the telephone book. Handset's been stolen twice. This is private property."
"I thought the payphone was public."
"Not as far as I'm concerned. That's strictly for motel customers. One of the amenities," she said. "Anyway, I could see the rainbow was closed and the outside lights were off. I poked my head out, but it was only Barrett calling her dad to pick her up. I offered her a lift, but she said he was already on his way."
"You have any idea if Rafer had picked up on the 911 dispatch?"
"You mean the ambulance for Tom?" "Probably," she said. "Or James might have called him, knowing they were such good friends."
She closed the ledger. "Now, I hope you'll excuse me. I have someone joining me for Sunday lunch."
"Sure, no problem. I appreciate your help."
I tucked my papers in the briefcase, gathered up the index cards and put a rubber band around them, and dropped them in there, too. I shrugged into my jacket, grabbed my handbag and the briefcase, and returned to my car at the Rainbow. So here's the question I asked myself. If Barrett left work at 9:30, why did it take her 45 minutes to an hour to call her dad? I sat in the car watching the clouds gather in a dark gray sky, watching the light dim down to a twilight state. It was only 1 o'clock in the afternoon, but the dark was so pervasive that the photo sensor on Cecilia's exterior lights popped to life. Snow began to fall, big airy flakes settling on the windshield like a layer of soap suds. I waited, watching the rear of the Rainbow Cafe. By 2:30, the lunch crowd was all but gone. I sat with the inborn patience of the cat watching for a lizard to reappear from the crevice between two rocks. At 2:44, the back door opened, and Barrett came out wearing her apron and her chef's toque and carrying a large plastic garbage bag, intended for the trash bin to my left. I rolled down the window. "Hi, Barrett. You have a minute?" She dumped the garbage bag and moved closer. I leaned over and unlocked the passenger door, pushing it open a crack. "Hop in. You'll freeze to death out there." She made no move. "I thought you were gone." "I was visiting Cecilia. What time do you get off work?" "Not for hours." "Why don't you take a break? I'd like to talk to you." She hesitated, looking toward the rainbow. "I'm really not supposed to, but it's okay for just a minute." She got in the car, slammed the door, and crossed her bare arms against the cold. I'd have run the engine for the heat, but I didn't want to waste the gas, and I was hoping her discomfort would motivate her to tell me what I wanted to know. "Your dad says you're on your way to med school."
"I haven't been accepted yet," she said.
"Where are you thinking to go?"
"Did you want something in particular? Because Nancy doesn't know I'm out here, and I really don't have a coffee break until closer to 3.
"I should get to the point now you mention it," I said. I could feel a fib start to form. For me, it's the same sensation as a sneeze in the making, that wonderful reaction of the autonomic nervous system when something tickles my nose.
"I was curious about something."
Please note she didn't ask what.
"Wasn't it you Tom Newquist was here to meet that night?"
"Why would he do that?"
"I have no idea. That's why I'm asking you," I said.
She must have done some acting at one point. Maybe high school, the senior play. Not the lead. She made a show of frowning, then shook her head in bafflement.
"I don't think so," she said, as though racking her brain.
"I have to tell you, he made a note on his desk calendar. He wrote Barrett, plain as day."
"He did?"
"I ran across it today, which is why I was asking earlier who he was here to meet. I was hoping you'd be honest, but you dropped the ball," I said. "I would have let it pass, but then the story was confirmed, so here I am."
"You want to tell me how it went?"
"Confirmed? As in verified," I said.
"Who confirmed it?"
"Cecilia."
"It wasn't anything," she said.
"Well, great. Cough it up in that case. I'd like to hear."
"We just talked a few minutes, and then he started feeling bad."
"What did you talk about?"
"Just stuff. We were chatting about my dad. I mean, it was nothing in particular, just idle conversation. Me and Brant used to go steady, and he was asking about the breakup. He always felt bad about we didn't hang in together. I knew he was leading up to something, but I didn't know what. Then he started feeling sick. I could see the color drain from his face, and he started sweating. I was scared."
"Did he say he was in pain?"
She nodded, her voice wavering when she spoke. "He was clutching his chest, and his breathing was all raspy. I said I'd go back to the motel and get some help, and he said, 'Fine, do that.' He told me to lock the truck door and not mention our meeting to anyone. He was real emphatic about that, made me promise. Otherwise, I might have told you when you asked the first time."
She fumbled in her uniform pocket and found a tissue. She swiped at her eyes and blew her nose. I waited until she was calmer before I went on.
"Did he say anything else?"
She took a deep breath.
"Stay off the road if any cars come along. He didn't want anyone to know I'd been talking to him."
"Why?"
"He didn't want to put me in any danger," was what he said.
"He didn't say from whom?"
"He didn't mention anyone by name," she said.
"What else?"
"That's everything."
"He didn't give you his notebook for safekeeping?" She shook her head mutely.
"Are you sure?"
"Positive."
"I thought he gave you the little black book where he kept his field notes." "Well, he didn't." Barrett, tell the truth. Please, please, please. Pretty please with sugar on it. Trust me, I won't say a word to anyone about your having it. I'm telling you the truth.
I shook my head. I hate to contradict you, but Tom always kept it with him, and yet nobody's seen it since he died.
So?
So everybody's been assuming he was by himself that night. Now it turns out you were in his truck. Where else could it be? He was anxious to protect the notebook, so he must have given it to you. That's the only way it adds up. If you can think of another explanation, I'd love to hear it.
The silence was exquisite. I let it drag on a bit without breathing another word.
I went for help.
I'm sure you did, I said. The CHP officer saw you on the road. What about the notebook?
Barrett looked out the window.
You don't have any proof, she said faintly.
Well, yeah, I know. I mean, except for the fact that Cecilia saw you on the motel porch that night, I said. She says your dad came and picked you up, which is what you said yourself. You just fudged a tiny bit about the sequence of events. I can't prove you have the notebook, but it stands to reason.
Nancy poked her head out of the Rainbow's back door. Barrett opened the door and leaned out, calling, I'll be right there.
Nancy nodded and waved.
So, where's the notebook?
In my purse, she said glumly.
Could you give it to me?
What's so important about the notes?
He was investigating two murders, so I'm assuming his notes are somehow relevant. Did you read them yourself?
Well, yeah, but it's just a bunch of interviews and stuff. Lots of dates and abbreviations. It's no big deal.
Then why does it matter if you pass it on to me?
He told me to hide it till he could decide what to do with it.
He didn't know he would die.
What a bummer, she said.
Look, if you'll give it to me now, I'll make a copy first thing tomorrow and give it back to you.
After an agonizing moment, she said,
All right.
She got out of the car on her side, and I got out on mine, locking the doors quickly before I followed her in. She kept her handbag in the storage room to the left of the kitchen door. Barrett took the notebook out of her bag and passed it to me. She seemed irritated that I'd managed to outmaneuver her somehow.
The other thing he said was, the keys on his desk, she said.
The keys in his desk?
That's what he told me. He said it twice.
In or on?
On, I think. I have to go.
Thanks, you're a doll. I put my finger to my lips.
Top secret. Not a word to anyone.
Shit, then why did I tell you?
Nancy stuck her head in the kitchen door.
Oh, Kinsey, you're here. Brant's on the phone, she said.
I went out into Cafe Proper, which was virtually deserted. The receiver was face down on the counter by the register.
Brant, is that you?
He said.
Hi, Kinsey.
Where are you? How'd you know I was here?
I'm at Mom's. I drove past the Rainbow a while ago and saw your car parked out back. I just wanted to check and make sure you're okay.
I'm fine. Is your mother home yet?
She won't get back till close to 9, he said.
You need something?
Not really. If you have a way to call her, would you let her know I got it?
Got what?
I curled my fingers around the mouthpiece, feeling like a character in a spy movie.
The notebook.
How'd you manage that?
I'll explain later. I'll be home in a few minutes. Can you wait?
Not really. I just stopped by for some stuff I'll be taking to Sherry's later.
You work weekends?
Not usually, he said. I'm filling in for someone and hoping to run some errands first. We'll talk tomorrow.
Right. I'll see you then, I said.
I let myself into Selma's house and headed out to the kitchen. The house was dim, silent, insufferably warm. Everything was much as I'd left it, except for a plastic-wrapped plate of brownies with chocolate frosting sitting on the counter, with a note attached. Help yourself. The condensation on the wrap suggested it had been refrigerated, or frozen until recently. Brant must have assumed the note was meant for him, because a plate and fork showing telltale traces of chocolate were sitting on the table at the place he occupied.
I was sorry I'd missed him. We could have put our heads together.
I went into Tom's study and sat down in his swivel chair. I turned on his desk light and started going through the notebook. The cover was a pebbly black leather, soft with wear, the corners bent. I took the obvious route, starting at the first page, dated June 1st, and working through to the last, which was dated February 1st, 2 days before he died. Here at last were the 10 months' worth of missing notes. The scribbles on thin-lined paper covered all the miscellaneous cases he'd been working on during that period. Each was identified by a case number in the margin to the left, and included complaints, crime scene investigations, names, addresses, and phone numbers of witnesses. In a series of nearly indecipherable abbreviations, I could trace the course of successive interviews on any given matter. Tom's notes to himself, his case references, the comments and questions that cropped up as he proceeded. There, in something close to hieroglyphics, I read about the discovery of Pinky's body, the findings of the coroner, Trey Kirchner, whom Tom referred to as Three. Any recurring name Tom generally reduced to its first letter. I found references to R and B, which I assumed were Rafer and Tom's boss, Sheriff Bob Staffer. By copious squints and leaps of imagination, I could see that he'd worked backward from Pinky's death to his incarceration in Chino, and his friendship with Alfie Toth, a fact confirmed by M.B. Margaret Brine at NLSD, Nota Lake Sheriff's Department. C.S. I took to refer to Colleen Sellers, sometimes referred to as C., who'd called to report Alfie Toth's jail time in S.T. I found the summary of his trip to Santa Teresa in June, including dates, times, mileage, and expenditures for food and lodging. As I'd learned earlier, he'd talked to Dave Estes at the Gramercy on 6-5. Later, he'd talked to Olga Toth, her address and phone number neatly noted. By the time C.S. called again to report the discovery of Toth's remains, Tom's notes had become cursory. Where previously he'd been meticulous about detailing the contents of conversations, he was suddenly circumspect, reverting, I suspected, to a code of some kind. The last page of notes contained only some numbers— 8, 12, 1, 11, and 26, writ large, and underlined with an exclamation point and question mark. Even the punctuation suggested a disbelief most emphatic. I sat and stared at the numbers until they danced on the page. I got up and went to the kitchen, where I paced the floor. I poured myself some water from the tap, and I drank it, making the most satisfactory gulping sounds. I put the glass in the dishwasher, and then, in a fit of tidiness, added Brant's fork and his plate. I let my brain off the hook, tending to idle occupations while I picked at the riddle. What the hell did the numbers 8, 12, 1, 11, and 26 signify? A date? The combination to a safe? I thought about Tom's telling Barrett about the key, in or on his desk. I'd been working at his desk for a week and hadn't seen any key that I remembered. What kind of key? The key to what? It's not as though his notebook had a tiny lock like a teenager's diary. I went back to the den and sat down at his desk, immediately searching through his drawers again. Maybe he had a lockbox. Maybe he had a home safe. Maybe he had a storage cupboard secured by a small combination lock. How many bags full of garbage had I thrown out this past week? How could I be sure I hadn't tossed the key he was referring to? I felt a wave of panic at the idea that I'd thrown out something crucial to his purposes and critical to mine. One by one I emptied the contents of each drawer, then removed the drawer itself, checking the back panel and the bottom. I got down on my hands and knees and peered at the underside of the desk, feeling along the sides in case a key had been taped in place. In the drawer, with his handcuffs and nightstick, I came across his flashlight and used that as I felt along the drawer rails. Tilted his swivel chair back to check the underside of the seat. Did he mean the key as a thing that explains or solves something else, or a literal key as an instrument or device to open a lock? I put the drawers back together and moved everything off the top. I ran a finger across his blotter, looking for a repetition of the numbers among the notes he'd scribbled. The numbers were there. 8, 12, 1, 11, 26. Appearing in the center of a noose. They were written twice more, once with a pen line encircling it, and once in a box with a shaded border done in pencil. What if I discarded the critical information? Had the trash been picked up? I was working hard to suppress the nagging worry I felt. I was in a white-hot sweat. The house, as usual, felt like an oven. I crossed to the window and lifted the sash. I loosened the catches on the storm door and pushed the glass out unceremoniously, watching with satisfaction as the window dropped to the ground below.
I swallowed mouthfuls of fresh air, hoping to quell my anxiety. I sat down at the desk again and shook my head. I cleared my mind of emotion, thinking back through the work I'd done earlier in the week. I didn't remember a key, but if I'd seen one, I knew I would never have discarded it. If I hadn't found the key yet, there was still the chance that I'd uncover it somewhere. So, the point was to keep searching as calmly and thoroughly as possible. Again, I went through each drawer, looking carefully at the contents. I checked each item in Tom's file folders, looked in envelopes, opened boxes of paper clips and staples, peered at pens, rulers, labels, tape. Maybe the key was a saying or a phrase that would make everything else clear. At the back of my mind, I kept returning to the notion that the numbers were a code of some kind. I'd never heard any mention of Tom's having worked in intelligence, so if I was right, the code was probably something simple and easily accessible. On or in his desk. I found a piece of paper and wrote out the alphabet in sequence, attaching the numbers 1 through 26 underneath. If the numbers 8, 12, 1, 11, and 26 were simple letter substitutions, then the name or initials would be H-L-A-K-Z. Which meant what? Nothing on the face of it. Something Los Angeles something something? Didn't suggest anything to me. I tried the same sequence backward, letting A correspond with the number 26, B correspond with 25, and so forth, until I reached the number 1, which I assumed represented Z. If this were the case, then the numbers 8, 12, 1, 11, 26 would spell out S-O-Z-P-A. Another puzzlement. What the hell was this, a name? My frustration level mounted at a pace with my confusion. 8, 12, 1, 11, 26. Months of the year? August, December, January, November? Then what did the 26 denote? And why out of order? Was I supposed to add, subtract, sound out the words phonetically like a vanity license plate? I repeated them aloud. 8, 12, 1, 11, 26. This meant nothing. If the numbers represented letters and this was a word, then all I knew for sure was that the five letters were different, with no repetitions. Someone's name? I thought about Noda Lake and how many people I'd met here who had five-letter first names. Brandt, Macon, Hatch, Wayne, James Tennyson, Rafer. I looked at the exclamation point and the question mark. Which said what? Consternation? Dismay? I realized I was famished, a manifestation of my anxiety, no doubt. Waiting for Barrett in the cafe parking lot, I'd skipped lunch altogether, and this was the price I paid. It was now 4:15. I went back to the kitchen in search of sustenance. I was so hungry and so befuddled, my brain cells felt like they'd quit holding hands. I looked in Selma's refrigerator, greeted by plastic-wrapped leftovers from last night's dinner. Not memorable to begin with, and certainly not worth re-eating. I checked the bread drawer. No crackers. I checked the cupboards. No peanut butter. What kind of household did she run? I glanced at her note, and in the absence of wholesome foodstuffs, I allowed myself to lift a corner of the plastic wrap and help myself to several brownies. The texture was off, a bit dry for my taste, but the icing was nice and gooey, only a faint chemical taste suggesting she'd used a boxed mix. Anyone who'd eat Miracle Whip would eat that shit, I thought. This was not Selma's best effort by a long stretch, but I figured my days consuming her cooking were just about over. I drank some milk from the carton, figuring to save a glass. Thus fortified, I was prepared to tackle the problem. I went back to Tom's swivel chair and swiveled. What if 8, 12, 1, 11, and 26 were page numbers referring to the notes themselves? I tried that approach, but the contents of the pages seemed in no way related, sharing no visible common elements and no designated page numbers. The afternoon was stretching toward evening, and I was getting nowhere. I went back to the original premise. Selma had hired me to find out why Tom was distressed. I slouched down on my spine and leaned my head on the back of the chair. Why was Tom brooding? Kinsey asked herself. I rocked, allowing myself to ruminate at my leisure. If someone he knew had violated his privacy, reading his notes and using the information to get to Alfie Toth to kill him, that would certainly do the trick.
But why would Hatch's involvement, or James's, or Wayne's, have generated a moment's uneasiness or hesitation? Tom played by the rules. I'd been told over and over he was strictly a law-and-order type. If he'd suspected any one of them, he'd have acted at once. Wouldn't he? Why would he not? It wouldn't have meant anything to him if Wayne had violated the sanctity of his field notes. My gaze dropped to the blotter. I pushed a stack of files aside. Down in the right-hand corner, Tom had drawn a grid, penning in the days of the month of February, the year unspecified. The first fell on a Sunday, the 28th on a Saturday. The last two Saturdays of the month, the 21st and the 28th, were crossed out. Was the year 1908, 1912, 1901, 1911, or 1926? I got up and went to the bookshelf where I took down a copy of his almanac. I thumbed to the index and found the page numbers for a perpetual calendar. In a table to the left, the years between 1800 and 2063 were listed in order. Beside each year was a number corresponding to a numbered template, representing all the variations in the way the months could be laid out. Calendar number 1 was a year in which January the 1st fell on a Sunday, February 1st fell on a Wednesday, and each month thereafter was depicted. Calendar number 2 represented any and all years in which January 1st fell on a Monday. February 1st fell on Thursday, and so forth. If you wanted to know the day of the month for a particular date, say March 5, 1966, you simply checked the master list for the year 1966, beside which appeared the number 7. Moving to calendar number 7, you could see that March 5th fell on a Saturday. I flipped on the desk light and studied the series of calendar pages, looking at the Februaries laid out like the one he'd drawn. Calendar number 5 was like that. February 1st fell on a Sunday, and the 28th fell on the last Saturday of the month. Calendar number 12 was similar, except there were 29 days instead of 28. I checked the years that corresponded, starting with 1900. 1903 was such a year, but not 1908, and not 1912. In 1914, the 1st fell on a Sunday, and the 28th on the last Saturday. But the same wasn't true of 1926. 1925, 1931, 1942, 1953, 1959, 1970, 1981, 1987, 1998. Why were these particular Februaries important? The year couldn't be relevant, could it? And why had he crossed out the last two Saturdays of that month? I thought about it for a minute. Eliminating those two Saturdays cut the number of days from 28 to 26, the number of letters in the alphabet. I tried that approach, lining up the letters with the days of the month. The answer was still H-L-A-K-Z. Still rocking in his desk chair, I swiveled toward the window. It was nearly 5:30, fully dark outside. Cold air still spilled through the gap where I'd raised the window. I could almost discern the waves of household heat pouring out in exchange. The room was decidedly chilly. I leaned forward and closed the window, staring at my reflection in the smoke-clouded glass. What the hell did those numbers mean? I could feel a draft from somewhere. Was there a draft coming down the chimney? Curious, I got up and moved out of the den. I walked along the front hall to the living room, where I turned on the table lamps. The drapes were wavering as though pushed by an unseen hand. I peered up the chimney and flipped the flue to the shut position. I checked the perimeter doors. The front door was closed and locked, as was the back door, and the door to the garage. That wasn't it. I poked my head into Selma's bedroom. All was undisturbed, yet the draft was such that the curtains rippled in the windows. I proceeded down the hall. All the windows in Brant's old bedroom were closed. I stopped where I was. The door to my room was ajar. Had I left it that way? I pushed it open with apprehension. Curtains flapped and fluttered. The room was a shambles. There were jagged shards of glass on the carpet. The window, which I'd oh so carefully locked, had been shattered by a hammer that someone had left on the floor. Pebbles of glass the size of rock salt were spread out across the sill like discarded diamonds. The sash had been pushed up, probably from the outside. Someone had clearly entered. I moved to the bed and slid my hand between the box spring and mattress. My gun was missing. Chapter 22. The Last Chapter. I glanced at my watch, 5:36. I walked back to the kitchen, prepared to dial 911. I hesitated, my hand on the receiver. Who was I going to call? Rafer? Brant? Tom's brother, Macon? I wasn't sure I trusted any one of them. I stood there, trying to determine whom I could confide in at this point. A chill went through me. Surely there wasn't anybody in the house with me. I hadn't gone to the guest room since I'd returned to the house early in the afternoon, so the intruder had probably been here and departed long before I showed up. Ordinarily, I'd have gone to my room to drop my jacket. After the day I'd had, I might have showered or napped, anything to perk myself up and restore my confidence. But I'd been intent on Tom's notes, and I'd gone directly to his den. I felt disembodied, my mind having been separated from my flesh by the harrowing sensation of fear. The phone shrilled with extraordinary loudness, setting off a surge of nausea. I jumped, nerves raw, my reflexes responding sharply, almost to the point of pain. I snatched up the receiver before it had ceased to ring. "Hello? Hey, Kinsey, Brant here. Is my mom home yet?" He sounded young and carefree, relaxed, unconcerned. My stomach churned in response. "You need to come home," I said. My voice seemed to be coming from a curious distance. He must have been alerted by my tone, because his shifted. "Why, what's going on?" "Someone's broken in. There's glass on the bedroom floor, and my gun is gone." "Where's Mom?" "I don't know." "Yes, wait. At your cousin's in Big Pine." "I'm here alone," I said. "Stay where you are. I'll be right there." He hung up. I replaced the receiver. I turned and leaned my back up against the wall, making little mewling sounds. A town full of cowboys, and someone was coming after me. I held my hands out in front of me. I could see my fingers tremble, the recently dislocated digits looking all puffy and useless. My gun had been stolen. I had to have a weapon, some way to defend myself against the coming onslaught. I started opening the kitchen drawers, one after the other, in search of a knife. One drawer flew off its rails and banged against my thigh, spilling out its contents. Utensils jangled together, tumbling to the floor at my feet. I could feel the tears stinging my lids. I gathered a fistful of items and tossed them back in the drawer, but I couldn't seem to get it mounted on its track again. I banged it on the countertop so hard a metal spatula bounced and flew out. I left the drawer where it was. I found a steak knife, some generic brand that looked like a giveaway in a box of detergent. The overhead light glinted off its surface. I could see the bevel on the blade. What good would a serrated steak knife do against a speeding bullet? Hours seemed to go by. I could hear the second hand on the kitchen clock tick each passing second in turn. Outside, I heard the squeal of brakes, and then a car door slammed shut. I turned and stared at the front door. What if it was someone else? What if it was them? The door flew open, and I could see Brant in his civilian clothes. He moved toward me with all the comforting bulk of a battleship. I put a hand out, and he took it. "Jesus, you look awful. How'd the guy get in?" I pointed to my room, and then found myself following as he moved purposefully down the hall in that direction. His assessment was brief, the most cursory of glances. He turned away from the guest room and toward the rest of the house methodically, looking in every closet, every nook and cranny. He went down to the basement. I waited at the top of the stairs, one hand plucking at the other. My injured fingers held a particular fascination for me, clumsy and swollen. Where was my gun? How could I defend myself when I'd left the knife on the counter? Brant returned to the kitchen. I followed him like a duckling. I could tell by his tone he was trying to control himself. Something in his manner conveyed the seriousness of the situation. Did he get the notebook? I found myself grinding my teeth. Who? The guy who broke in, he said sharply. It was in my bag, I said. Is that what he was after? Of course, Brant said. I can't think why else he'd risk it. Tell me exactly what you did today. What time did you leave, and how long were you gone? I felt burbling and incoherent, spilling out the story of my rebuff, the refusal of the gas station attendants to do business with me, my subsequent stop at the Rainbow to talk to Nancy. I told him I'd run into Rafer and Vic, that I'd talk to Cecilia and Barrett. My brain was moving at twice the speed of my lips, making me feel sluggish and stupid. Brandt, God bless him, seemed to follow the staccato pace of the narrative, filling in the blanks when an occasional word came up missing. What was wrong with me? I knew I'd felt like this before, this scared, this powerless, this out of it. Brandt was staring at me. You actually talked to him? What was he talking about? Who? I sounded like an owl. Rafer. What had I asked? What had he said before this? What did Rafer have to do with anything? What? Rafer, at the Rainbow. Yes, I ran into him at the Rainbow. I know that. You told me. I'm asking you if you talked to him, he said with exaggerated patience. Sure. You talked to him? His voice had risen with alarm. I could see the question mark and the exclamation point hurling through the air at me. I brought him up to date, I said. My voice was delayed like something in an echo chamber. Words in balloons bumped together above my head, images like projectiles flying off in all directions. I told you to wait till I could check it out. Who do you think started all the rumors? Who? Brandt took me by the shoulders and gave me a little shake. He seemed angry, his fingers biting into my shoulders. Kinsey, wake up and pay attention. This is serious, he said. You're not saying it was him? Of course it was him. Who else could it be? Think about it, dummy. Think about what? I asked, confused. The immediacy of his discomposure was contagious. I was relying on him for help, but his anxiety was pushing mine into the danger zone. His voice pounded on, pleading and cajoling, wheedling. You told Mom it was someone in law enforcement. Do you honestly think my father would have lost even one night's sleep if it was anyone but Rafer? Rafer was his best friend. The two of them had worked together for years and years. Dad thought Rafer was one of the finest cops who ever lived. Now he finds out he killed two guys? Jeez, he must have shit himself when he understood what was going on. Didn't he write this down? Isn't this in his notes? His words were like streamers blowing above his head. I heard snapping like flags. The notes are in code. I can't read them. Where? Can you show me? Maybe I can crack it. In there. You think he was on the verge of talking to Internal Affairs? Of course. The decision couldn't have been easy, but even as loyal as he was to Rafer, the department came first. He must have been praying for a way out, hoping he was wrong. My brain worked lickety-cut. It was my mouth that fumbled, thoughts crashing against my teeth like rocks. I had to clamp my jaw shut, barely moving my lips. I talked to Barrett. She was with Tom in the truck just before he died, I said. What did they talk about? Why did he do that? Something. I can't remember. Didn't you press her for answers? You had the girl right there in the palm of your hand, he said. His words appeared in the air, written in big capital letters. Quit yelling. I'm not yelling. What's the matter with you? Barrett never said a word about Rafer. I remembered then. She did say Tom had asked about her father. Why would she? She doesn't know you from Adam. She's not going to confide. She wouldn't tell you something like that. Her own father? For God's sake, she'd have to be nuts, he shrilled. But why give me the notes? Wouldn't she assume they'd be incriminating? Barrett doesn't have a clue. She has no idea. How do you know what he did? Because I can add, he said, exasperated. I put two and two together. Listen, Tom met with Barrett. He was probably trying to find out about Rafer's whereabouts when Pinky was murdered. Same with Alfie Toth. He saw the connection. He worried someone in the department would get wind of his suspicions. Didn't you say that? Someone had already ripped him off for the information about Toth. Who do you think it was? Rafer. Rafer, I said. I was nodding. I could see what he was saying. I'd been thinking the same thing. Tom's friendship with Rafer was such that he'd think long and hard before he turned him into the authorities, betraying their friendship.
A conflict of that magnitude would have caused him extreme distress. My brain was clicking and buzzing. Click, click, click. Rafer. It was like a pinball game. Thoughts ricocheted around, setting off bells, bouncing against the rails. I thought about the clerk at the Gramercy. Why didn't he tell me the phony plainclothes detective was black? You'd think he'd remember something so obvious. My mind kept veering. I couldn't hold a thought in one place and follow it to its conclusion. Click, click. Like pool balls. The cue ball would break and all the other balls on the table would fly off in separate directions. I wish I'd talked to Leland Peck before I left Santa Teresa. I was feeling very weird, so anxious. Sound fading in and out. I could see it undulate through space, sentences like surfers cresting on the waves of air. Brant was still talking. He seemed to be speaking gibberish, but it all made a peculiar sense. Pinky went after Barrett. She was hiking in the mountains and stumbled across their fishing camp. On and on he went, creating word pictures so vivid I thought it was happening to me. Barrett was assaulted. He put a gun to her head. She was raped. She was attacked and sexually abused. Pinky sodomized and hurt her. He forced her to perform unspeakable acts. Alfie did nothing, offered her no assistance, ran off, leaving her to Pinky's mercy. Barrett came back hysterical, in a state of shock. Rafer went after Pinky and took him down. He strung him up, hung him from the limb of a tree, and let him die slowly for what he had done to her. He would have killed Alfie, too, but Alfie escaped in Blue Town. Rafer thought he was safe all these years, and then Pinky's body turned up, and Dad found the link between the two men. He drove all the way to Santa Teresa to talk to him, but Rafer got there first. He hung Toth the same way he hung Pinky. Brant was looking at me earnestly. What's wrong with your eyes? My eyes? Once he mentioned it, I realized my field of vision had begun to oscillate, images sliding side to side, like bad camera work. I felt giddy, as if I was on the verge of fainting. I sat down. I put my head between my knees, a roaring in my ears. Are you okay? Fine. Light seemed to pulsate and sounds came and went. I couldn't keep it straight. I knew what he was saying, but I couldn't make the words stand still. I saw Rafer with the noose. I saw him tighten it on Pinky's neck. I saw him hang Alfie in the wilderness. I felt his rage and his pain for what they'd done to his only daughter. I said, "How do you know all this?" "Because Barrett told me when it happened. Jesus, Kinsey, that's why I broke up with her. I was 20 years old. I couldn't handle it," he said, anguished. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry," I said, but immediately forgot who was more deserving of my pity. Barrett for being raped, Brant for not having the maturity to deal with it. Brant's tone became accusatory. "You're loaded. I don't believe it. What the hell are you high on?" "I'm high?" "Of course." Daniel playing the piano. My ex-husband. So beautiful. Eyes like an angel, a halo of golden curls, and how I'd loved him. He'd given me acid once without telling me, and I watched the floor recede into the mouth of hell. Brant's head came up. "What's that?" he hissed. "What?" "I heard something." His agitation washed over me. His fear was infectious, as swift as an airborne virus. I could smell corruption and death. I'd been in situations like this before. "Hang on." Brant strode down the hall. I saw him look out of the small ornamental window in the front door. He pulled back abruptly and then gestured urgently in my direction. "A car cruised by with its lights doused. He's parked across the street about 6 doors down. You have a gun?" "I told you someone stole it. Whoever broke in. I don't have a gun. What's happening?" "Rafer," he said grimly. He crossed to the drawer in his mother's kitchen desk, where she did her menu planning. He pulled out a gun and thrust it in my hand. "Here, take this." I stood and stared at it with bewilderment. "Thanks," I whispered. The gun was a basic police revolver, Smith & Wesson. I'd nearly bought one like it once. 357 Magnum, 4-inch barrel, checkered walnut stocks. I studied the grooves in the stock. Some of them were so deep I couldn't see to the bottom. "Rafer will come in with guns blazing," Brant was saying. "No deals.
He's told everyone that you're a killer, that you do drugs, and here you are stoned on something.
I didn't do anything, I said, mouth dry.
The brownies. I was higher than he knew. I racked back through my memory, classes at the police academy, my years in uniform on the street, trying to remember symptoms. Phencyclidines, stimulants, hallucinogens, sedative hypnotics, narcotics. What had I ingested? Confusion, paranoia, slurred speech, nystagmus. I could see the columns marching across the pages of the text. PCP vocabulary. Rocket fuel, DOA, KJ, superjoint, mintweed, gorilla biscuits. I was out of my brain on speed.
You found him out. He'll have to kill you. We'll have to shoot it out, Brandt said.
Don't leave me. You talk to him. I can get away, I burbled.
He's thought of that. He'll have help. Probably Macon and Hatch. They both hate you. We better get down to business.
When Brandt peeled off his outer jacket, I smelled stress sweat, the scent as acrid and piercing as ammonia. I glanced at his hands. Given any visual field, the eye tends to stray to the one different item in a ground of like items. Even bombed, I caught sight of a blemish on his right wrist, a dark patch, a tattoo or a birthmark, shaped like the prow of a ship. The blot stood out like a brand on the clean white surface of his skin. Sizzling, my brain zapped through the possibilities. Scar, hickey, smudge, scab. I was slow on the uptake. I looked back and then I saw it for what it was. The mark was a burn. The healing discoloration was a match for the tip of the ticking hot iron I'd pressed on him. Adrenaline rushed through me. Something close to euphoria filled my flesh and bones. My mind made an odd leap to something else altogether. I'd been struggling to break the code with logic and analysis when the answer was really one of spatial relationships. Vertical, not horizontal. That's how the numbers worked. Up and down instead of back and forth across the lines. I put the gun on the kitchen table.
I'll be right back, I said.
With extraordinary effort, I propelled myself into Tom's den, hand to the wall to steady my yawning gait. 8, 12, 1, 11, and 26. I sat down at his desk and looked at the calendar Tom had drawn. I could see the month of February, 28 days penned in with the first falling on a Sunday, and the last two Saturdays, the 21st and the 28th, crossed out, leaving 26 numbers. I'd suspected the code was simple. If Tom encrypted his notes, he had to have an uncomplicated means by which to convert letters to numbers. I found a pencil. I turned to the calendar grid that he'd drawn on the corner of his blotter. I wrote the letters of the alphabet, inserting one letter per day, using vertical rows this time. If my theory was correct, then the code would confirm what I already knew. 8 would represent the letter B. The number 12 would stand in for the letter R. The number 1 would be A, and 11 would represent a N. And the 26 would be T. B-R-A-N-T. Brandt. I could feel a laugh billow up. I was stuck in the house with him. He would have had easy access to his father's notes. The search of the den, the broken window, both had been a cover, suggesting to the rest of us that someone from the outside had entered the house in hopes of finding the notes. It wasn't Barrett at all. Pinky hadn't raped and sodomized Barrett. It was Brandt he'd humiliated and degraded.
What are you doing?
I jumped. Brandt was standing in the doorway. I was standing in horseshit up to my underpants. The sight of him wavered, shimmering, image moving side to side. I couldn't think of a way to answer. Nystagmus. Something in brownies. Possibly PCP. Aggression, paranoia. I was smarter than him. Oh, much smarter. I was smarter than anyone that day.
What are you looking at?
Tom's notes.
Why?
I can't make head or tails of them. The code. He stared at me. I could tell he was trying to determine if what I'd said was true. I kept my mind empty. I don't think I'd ever seen him looking so lean and young and handsome. Death is like that, a lover whose embrace you sink into without warning. Instead of flight or resistance, voluptuous surrender.
He held out his hand.
I'll take the notes.
I passed the notebook across to him, picturing the Smith and Wesson. Where had I heard about a gun like that before? I could feel my brain crackling, thoughts popping like kernels banging against the lid of a popcorn pan. There was no way in the world he would give me a gun unless he intended to see that I was killed with it. Rafer Lamotte wasn't outside, and neither was anybody else. This was a charade, setting me up in some way. I envisioned the scene, the two of us skulking through the house, ostensibly waiting for an attack that would never come. Brandt could shoot me any time he chose, claiming later he'd mistaken me for an intruder, claiming self-defense, claiming I was stoned out of my gourd, which I was. Even as the thought formed, I felt the drugs kick up a notch. I could feel myself expanding. I could outsmart him. He was strong, but I had more experience than he did. I knew more about him than he knew about me. I'd been a cop once. I knew everything he knew, plus some. "Is the car still out there?" I asked. Brandt dropped back into his fantasy. He moved to the window and put his face close to the glass, peering off to the right. "Down half a block. You can barely see it from here." I think we should turn the lights out. I don't like standing here in plain view. He studied me for a second, picturing the house black as pitch. You're right. Hit the switch. I'll take care of all the other lights in the house. Good. I turned the den light out. I waited until I heard him moving down the hall toward the front. Then I eased to the window, flipped the lock, and pushed the sash up about 6 inches. I dropped down to the floor, felt my way across the room to the cabinet, and slid myself feet first into the space beneath the bookshelves. Birth in reverse. I was hidden from view. Moments went by, the house becoming darker by the minute, as lamps were being switched off in every room Brandt entered.
Kinsey?
Brandt was back. Silence. I heard him come to the den. He must have stood in the doorway, allowing his eyes to adjust to the black. He crossed to the window, bumping into cardboard boxes. I heard him force the window open and look out. I was gone. There was no sign of me running across the grass. Shit! He slammed the window shut and said, Shit, shit, shit! He must have had a gun because I heard him rack one into the chamber. He left the den, hollering my name as he went. Now he was mad. Now he didn't care if I knew he was coming. I pulled myself out of the cabinet, hanging onto the shelf as I staggered to my feet. I crossed to the desk and opened the bottom drawer as quietly as possible. I took out Tom's handcuffs and tucked them in my back pocket. I could feel myself swell with power. I was suddenly larger than life, far beyond fear, luminous with fury. As I turned right out of the den into the darkness of the hallway, I could see him moving ahead of me, his body mass blacker than the charcoal light surrounding him. I began to run, picking up speed, my Reeboks making no sound on the carpet. Brandt sensed my presence, turning as I lifted myself into the air. I snapped a hard front kick to his solar plexus, taking him down with one pop. I heard his gun thump dully against the wall, banging against wood as it flew out of his hand. I kicked him again, catching him squarely on the side of the head. I scrambled to my feet and stood over him. I could have crushed his skull. But, as a courtesy, I refrained from doing so. I pulled the handcuffs from my pocket. I grabbed the fingers of his right hand and bent them backward, encouraging compliance. I lay the cuff on his right wrist and snapped downward, smiling grimly to myself as the swinging arm of the cuff locked in place. I put my left foot on the back of his neck while I yanked his right arm behind him, and I grabbed for his left. I would have stomped down on his face, pulverizing his nose if he'd so much as whimpered. He was out cold. I double-locked both handcuffs in place. All of this without hesitation. All of this in the dark. The light in the kitchen was snapped on. Selma appeared in the doorway, still wearing her fur coat. She stood as still as a soldier and took in the sight before her. Brandt was now moaning. Blood was pouring from his nose, and he was struggling for breath.
"Mom, watch out! She's stoned!"
he croaked. Selma backed into the kitchen. I was moving away from her down the corridor, looking for Brandt's gun, when she showed up again, this time with the Smith & Wesson in her right hand. I had no idea where Brandt's gun had gone. I remembered the telltale thump at the end of its airborne journey.
"Stop right there," she said. She was now holding the gun with two hands, arms extended stiffly at shoulder height. I went about my business, ignoring her little drama. She had no way of knowing I'd been sanctified by angel dust. I was higher than a kite on PCP, methamphetamines, whatever it was, some amazing mix of excitation and immortality. The unpleasant side effects were now gone, and I was detached from all feeling, secure in the sense that I would prevail over this bitch and anyone else who came after me. "You're not going to take my son away from me." As much as anything, I was annoyed with her. "I told you to forget it. You should have left well enough alone. Now you've not only lost Tom, you've lost Brant as well," I said conversationally. I got down on my hands and knees and felt under the chair. Where the hell was Brant's gun? "You are completely mistaken. I haven't lost Brant at all," she said. "Now get up right this minute. Do as I say." "Blow it out your ass, Selma. Do you see Brant's gun? I heard it bang against the wall. It's got to be here somewhere." "I'm warning you. I'll count to three, and then I'm going to shoot you." "You do that," I said. I moved into the dining room, convinced the gun had somehow become wedged under the hutch, the centerpiece in Selma's entire set of handsome, formal, glossy, dark wood furniture. I placed my shoulder against the floor, reaching under the hutch as far as the length of my arm. It was in this awkward position, me spread-eagled on my stomach, Brant handcuffed and moaning in the hall, Selma angling herself into position to blow my head off if she could manage it, that I chanced to look up at her, watching in slow-motion amazement as she screwed up her face, closed her eyes, turned her head, and squeezed the trigger. There was a large bang and a bright flash. The bullet exited the barrel at a lethal velocity. The normal football-shaped muzzle flashed out the front of the gun, and the vertical fan-shaped flashes at the cylinder gap seemed to be enhanced, a dazzling yellow. Brant had apparently packed the first cartridge with an overload of fast powder. I thought I knew now who Judy Gelson's lover was the night she blew a hole in her husband's chest. The chamber and the top strap ruptured. The blast unlatched the cylinder and drove it out to the left side of the gun. The brass cartridge case shredded, and tiny bits of brass peppered Selma's hands, flakes of unburned powder peppering her face as well. Simultaneously, as though by magic, all the glass in the cabinet doors, including the crystal goblets and the bone china plates, exploded like fireworks and formed a glittering starburst of falling glass and debris. "Fuck! That was great! You should try that again," I said. Selma was weeping as I walked to the phone and dialed 911. Epilogue. Later, the Nota County Sheriff gave me permission to read the file on the Ritter Toth murders. Rafer and I sat down together, and by comparing Tom's notes with other reports submitted in the case, we managed to piece together the course of Tom's investigation. The irony, of course, was that the evidence he'd collected was not only spotty, but entirely circumstantial. None of it was sufficient to result in an arrest, let alone a conviction. Tom realized Brant had committed double murder, and he knew it was something he couldn't keep to himself for long. Revealing the truth would destroy his marriage. Concealing the truth would destroy everything else he valued. Tom had died in silence, and if Selma had been content to leave it there, the case might have died too. Brant is currently out on bail on a charge of attempted murder for what he did to me. Selma's hired a fancy-pants attorney, who naturally advised him to plead not guilty. I suspect if we get to court, this same attorney will find a way to blame the whole thing on me. That's the way justice seems to work these days. In the meantime, Selma's house is on the market, and she's leaving Nota Lake. The town is unforgiving, and the people there never liked her anyway. I guess what it all boils down to is a lesson in personal insecurity and low self-esteem. If I'd been clairvoyant, if I'd been capable of seeing all these events in advance, I'd have told her to have her teeth capped instead of hiring me. She'd have been better off that way. Respectfully submitted, Kinsey Milhone.
This concludes the reading of N is for Noose by Sue Grafton. This book was read by Mary Pfeiffer.